to double in price, why is she working for my 3% commission when $250,000 is staring her in the face? 3. Perhaps my real estate agent is a moron, too. In that case, where are all the other buyers looking for bargains, especially after this house is featured in Crane Chicago Business? If this brownstone is a tremendous bargain and has been widely advertised as such, then presumably all kinds of people are going to want to buy it. A bidding war would result, with potential buyers offering larger and larger sums until the price reached its fair market value, which is around $500,000. In other words, there's virtually no chance that you'll find a Lincoln Park brownstone without some surprise lurking in the basement for $250,000. Why? Because of the most basic idea in economics. You're trying to maximize your utility, and so is everyone else. In a world in which everyone is looking to make profitable investments, no one is going to leave $250,000 sitting on the table. Yet people assume the stock market works like this all the time. We believe that after reading about a hot stock in Business Week, or reading a Wall Street analyst's buy recommendation offered to all the firm's clients, we can load up on stocks that will trounce the market average. But those supposed hot stocks are merely the Lincoln Park brownstone in different clothing. Here's why. Let's start with a stunningly simple but often overlooked point. Every time you buy a stock, or any other asset, someone has to sell it to you. The guy who sells you this hot stock has decided that he'd rather have cash. He's looked at the current bargain price, and he wants out, right when you're getting in. Sure, he may need the money for something else, but he's still going to demand a fair market price, just as we'd expect someone who has to move out of Lincoln Park to ask $500,000 for a brownstone, not $250,000. The stock market, as the name would suggest, is a market. The price of a stock at any given time is the price at which the number of buyers equals the number of sellers. Half of the investors trading your hot stock are trying to get rid of it. Or maybe you know something that the sellers don't. Perhaps all the people unloading XYZ Corp missed the Wall Street Journal article about XYZ's new blockbuster drug for male pattern baldness. Okay, that might happen. But where are the world's other sophisticated buyers? This stock is a sure thing at $45, yet for some reason, Warren Buffett, the traders at Goldman Sachs, and the top Fidelity portfolio managers are not snapping it up. If they were, the stock would be bid up to a much higher price, just like the Lincoln Park brownstone. Do you know something that no one else on Wall Street knows? Bearing in mind that trading on any information not available to the public is against the law? Or maybe someone on Wall Street is pitching you this stock idea. America's brokerage houses employ a cadre of analysts who spend their days kicking the tires of corporate America. Is all that information wrong? No, though there are plenty of cases of incompetence and conflict of interest. Analysts provide all kinds of legitimate information, just like your real estate agent. When you're shopping for a home, your agent can tell you about neighborhoods, schools, taxes, crime, the kinds of things that matter. Wall Street analysts do the same things for companies. They report on management, future products, the industry, the competition. But that does nothing to guarantee that you're going to earn an above-average return on the stock. The problem is that everyone else has access to the same information. This is the essence of the efficient markets theory. The main premise of the theory is that asset prices already reflect all available information. Thus, it's difficult, if not impossible, to choose stocks that'll outperform the market with any degree of consistency. Why can't you buy a brownstone in Lincoln Park for $250,000? Because buyers and sellers recognize that such a home is worth much more. A share of XYZ Corp is no different. Stock prices settle at a fair price given everything we know or can reasonably predict. prices will rise or fall in the future only in response to unanticipated events, things that we cannot know in the present. Picking stocks is a lot like trying to pick the shortest checkout line at the grocery store. Do some lines move faster than others? Absolutely, just as some stocks outperform others. Are there things that you can look for that signal how fast one line will move relative to another? Yes. You don't want to be behind the guy with two full shopping carts or the old woman clutching a fistful of coupons. So why is it that we seldom end up in the shortest line at the grocery store, and most professional stock pickers don't beat the market average? Because everyone else is looking at the same things we are and acting accordingly. They can see the guy with two shopping carts, the cashier in training at register 3, the coupon queen lined up at register 6. Everybody at the checkout tries to pick the fastest line. Sometimes you'll be right, sometimes you'll be wrong. Over time, they'll average out, so that if you go to the grocery store often enough, you'll probably spend about the same amount of time waiting in line as everyone else. Indeed, we can take the analogy one step further. Suppose that somewhere near the produce aisle, you saw an old woman stuffing wads of coupons in her pockets. When you arrive at the checkout and see her in line, you wisely steer your cart somewhere else. As she gets out her coin purse and begins slowly handing coupons to the cashier, you smugly congratulate yourself. Moments later, however, you realize the guy ahead of you forgot to weigh his avocados. "Price check on avocados at register 3, your cashier barks repeatedly as you watch the coupon lady push her groceries out of the store. Who could have predicted that? No one. Just as no one would have predicted that MicroStrategy, a high-flying software company, would restate its income on March 19, 2000, essentially wiping millions of dollars of earnings off its books. The stock fell $140 in one day, a 62% plunge. Did the investors and portfolio managers who bought MicroStrategy shares think this was going to happen? Of course not. It's the things you can't predict that matter. Indeed, the next time you're tempted to invest a large sum of money in a single stock, even that of a large and well-established firm, repeat these magic words: Enron, 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 or Lehman, Lehman, Lehman. Proponents of the efficient markets theory have advice for investors. Just pick a line and stand in it. If assets are priced efficiently, then a monkey throwing darts at the stock pages should choose a portfolio that will perform as well, on average, as the portfolios picked by the Wall Street stars. Burton Malkiel has pointed out that since diversification is important, the monkey should actually throw a wet towel at the stock pages. Indeed, investors now have access to their own monkey with a towel: index funds. Index funds are mutual funds that do not purport to pick winners. Instead, they buy and hold a predetermined basket of stocks, such as the S&P 500, the index that comprises America's largest 500 companies. Since the S&P 500 is a broad market average, we'd expect half of America's actively managed mutual funds to perform better, and half to perform worse. But that's before expenses. Fund managers charge fees for all the tire-kicking they do. They also incur costs as they trade aggressively. Index funds, like towel-throwing monkeys, are far cheaper to manage. But that's all theory. What do the data show? It turns out that the monkey with a towel can be an investor's best friend. According to Morningstar, a firm that tracks mutual funds, slightly fewer than half of the U.S. actively managed diversified funds beat the S&P 500 over the past year. A more impressive 66% of actively managed funds beat the S&P 500 over the past 5 years. But look what happens as the time frame gets longer. Only 45% of actively managed funds beat the S&P over a 20-year stretch, which is the most relevant time frame for people saving for retirement or college. In other words, 55% of the mutual funds that claim to have some special stock-picking ability did worse over two decades than a simple index fund, our modern equivalent of a monkey throwing a towel at the stock pages. If you had invested $10,000 in the average actively managed equity fund in 1973, when Malkiel's heretical book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, first came out, it would be worth $355,091 today, many editions later. If you had invested the same amount of money in an S&P 500 index fund, it would now be worth $364,066. Data notwithstanding, the efficient markets theory is obviously not the most popular idea on Wall Street. There's an old joke about two economists walking down the street. One of them sees a $100 bill lying in the street and points it out to his friend. "Is that a $100 bill lying in the gutter?" he asks. "No," his friend replies. "If it were a $100 bill, someone would have picked it up already." So they walk on by. Neither the housing market nor the stock market has behaved lately in ways consistent with such a sensible and orderly view of human behavior. Some of the brightest minds in finance have been chipping away at the efficient markets theory. Behavioral economists have documented the ways in which individuals make flawed decisions. We are prone to herd-like behavior. We have too much confidence in our own abilities. We place too much weight on past trends when predicting the future, and so on. Given that a market is just a collection of individuals' decisions, it stands to reason that if individuals get things wrong in systematic ways, like overreacting to good and bad news, then markets can get things wrong too, like bubbles and busts. There's even a new field, neuroeconomics, that combines economics, cognitive neuroscience, and psychology to explore the role that biology plays in our decision-making. One of the most bizarre and intriguing findings is that people with brain damage may be particularly good investors. Why? Because damage to certain parts of the brain can impair the emotional responses that cause the rest of us to do foolish things. A team of researchers from Carnegie Mellon, Stanford, and the University of Iowa conducted an experiment that compared the investment decisions made by 15 patients with damage to the areas of the brain that control emotions, but with intact logic and cognitive functions, to the investment decisions made by a control group. The brain-damaged investors finished the game with 13% more money than the control group. Largely, the authors believe, because they do not experience fear and anxiety. The impaired investors took more risks when there were high potential payoffs and got less emotional when they made losses. This book is not prescribing brain injury as an investment strategy. However, behavioral economists do believe that by anticipating the flawed decisions that regular investors are likely to make, we can beat the market, or at least avoid being ravaged by it. Yale economist Robert Shiller first challenged the theory of efficient markets in the early 1980s. He became much more famous for his book, Irrational Exuberance, which argued in 2000 that the stock market was overvalued. He was right. 5 years later, he argued that there was a bubble in the housing market. He was right again. If irrational investors are leaving $100 bills strewn about, shouldn't we be able to pick them up somehow? Yes, argues Richard Thaler, a University of Chicago economist, and the guy who took away the bowl of cashews from his guests back in Chapter 1. Thaler has even been willing to put his money where his theory is. He and some collaborators created a mutual fund that would take advantage of our human imperfections. The Behavioral Growth Fund. I'll even admit that after I interviewed Mr. Thaler for Chicago Public Radio, I decided to toss aside my strong belief in efficient markets and invest a small sum in his fund. How is it done? Very well. The Behavioral Growth Fund has produced an average return of 4.5% a year since its inception, compared to an average annual return of 2.3% for the S&P 500. The efficient markets theory isn't going anywhere soon. In fact, it's still a crucial concept for any investor to understand for two reasons. First, markets may do irrational things, but that doesn't make it easy to make money off those crazy movements, at least not for long. As investors take advantage of a market anomaly, say by buying up stocks that have been irrationally underpriced, they'll fix the very inefficiency that they exploited by bidding up the price of the underpriced stocks until they aren't underpriced anymore. Think about the original analogy of trying to find the fastest checkout line at the grocery store. Suppose you do find one line that moves predictably faster than the others. Maybe it has a really fast cashier and a nimble bagger. This outcome is observable to other shoppers. They're going to pile into your special line until it's not particularly fast anymore. The chances of you picking the shortest line week after week are essentially nil. Mutual funds work the same way. If a portfolio manager starts beating the market, others will see his oversized returns and copy the strategy, making it less effective in the process. So even if you believe that there will be an occasional $100 bill lying on the ground, you should also recognize that it won't be lying there for long. Second, the most effective critics of the efficient markets theory think the average investor probably can't beat the market and shouldn't try. Andrew Lowe of MIT and A. Craig McKinley of the Wharton School are the authors of a book entitled A Non-Random Walk Down Wall Street, in which they assert that financial experts with extraordinary resources, such as supercomputers, can beat the market by finding and exploiting pricing anomalies. A Business Week review of the book noted, surprisingly, perhaps, Lowe and McKinley actually agree with Malkiel's advice to the average investor. If you don't have any special expertise or the time and money to find expert help, they say, go ahead and purchase index funds. Warren Buffett, arguably the best stock picker of all time, says the same thing. Even Richard Thaler, the guy beating the market with his behavioral growth fund, told the Wall Street Journal that he puts most of his retirement savings in index funds. Indexing is to investing what regular exercise and a low-fat diet are to losing weight. A very good starting point. The burden of proof should fall on anyone who claims to have a better way. As I've already noted, this chapter is not an investment guide. I'll leave it to others to explain the pros and cons of college savings plans, municipal bonds, variable annuities, and all the other modern investment options. That said, basic economics can give us a sniff test. It provides us with a basic set of rules to which any decent investment advice must conform. Save, invest, repeat. Let's return to the most basic idea in this chapter. Capital is scarce. This is the only reason that any kind of investing yields returns. If you have spare capital, then someone will pay you to use it. But you've got to have the spare capital first. And the only way to generate spare capital is to spend less than you earn, that is, save. The more you save, and the sooner you begin saving it, the more rent you can command from the financial markets. Any good book on personal finance will dazzle you with the virtues of compound interest. Suffice it here to note that Albert Einstein is said to have called it the greatest invention of all time. The flip side, of course, is that if you're spending more cash than you earn, then you'll have to rent the difference somewhere. And you'll have to pay for that privilege. Paying the rent on capital is no different from paying the rent on anything else. It's an expense that crowds out other things you may want to consume later. The cost of living better in the present is living less well in the future. Conversely, the payoff for living frugally in the present is living better in the future. So for now, Set aside questions about whether your 401k should be in stocks or bonds. The first step is far more simple. Save early, save often, and pay off the credit cards. Take risk. Earn reward. Okay, now we'll talk about whether your 401k should be in stocks or bonds. Suppose you have capital to rent, and you're deciding between two options: lending it to the federal government, a treasury bond, or lending it to your neighbor Lance, who has been tinkering in his basement for 3 years and claims to have invented an internal combustion engine that runs on sunflower seeds. Both the federal government and your neighbor Lance are willing to pay you 6% interest on the loan. What to do? Unless Lance has photos of you in a compromising position, you should buy the government bond. The sunflower combustion engine is a risky proposition. The government bond is not. Lance may eventually attract the capital necessary to build his invention, but not by offering a 6% return. Riskier investments must offer a higher expected return in order to attract capital. That's not some arcane law of finance. It's simply markets at work. No rational person will invest money somewhere when he or she can earn the same expected return with less risk somewhere else. The implication for investors is clear. You will be compensated for taking more risk. Thus, the more risky your portfolio, the higher your return, on average. Yes, it's that pesky concept of average again. If your portfolio is risky, it also means that some very bad things will occasionally happen. Nothing encapsulates this point better than an old headline in the Wall Street Journal: "Bonds let you sleep at night, but at a price." The story examined stock and bond returns from 1945 to 1997. Over that period, a portfolio of 100% stocks earned an average annual return of 12.9%. A portfolio of 100% bonds earned a relatively meager 5.8% average annual return over the same period. So you might ask yourself, who are the chumps holding bonds? Not so fast. The same story then examined how the different portfolios performed in their worst years. The stock portfolio lost 26.5% of its value in its worst year. The bond portfolio never lost more than 5% of its value in a single bad year. Similarly, the stock portfolio had negative annual returns 8 times between 1945 and 1997. The bond portfolio lost money only once. The bottom line: risk is rewarded if you have a tolerance for it. That brings us back to the Harvard Endowment, which lost about a third of its value during the 2008 financial crisis. And Yale lost a quarter of its endowment in 1 year alone. Meanwhile, over the same stretch of dismal economic circumstances, my mother-in-law earned about a 3% return by keeping nearly all of her assets in certificates of deposit and a checking account. Is my mother-in-law an investment genius? Should Harvard have directed more of its assets to a giant checking account? No and no. My mother-in-law always keeps her assets in safe but low-yielding investments because she has a small appetite for risk. She's protected when times are bad. Of course, that also means that if the stock market posts an 18% gain 1 year, she earns 3%. Meanwhile, Harvard and Yale and other schools with large endowments earned enormous returns during the boom years by taking large risks and making relatively illiquid investments. Liquidity is the reflection of how quickly and predictably something can be turned into cash. Illiquid investments, like rare art or Venezuelan corporate bonds, must pay a premium to compensate for this drawback. Of course, when you need to get rid of them quickly to raise cash, it's a problem. These institutions pay an occasional price for their aggressive portfolios, but those bumps should be more than offset in the long run with returns that are a heck of a lot better than a certificate of deposit. Most important, the endowments are different than the typical investor planning for college or retirement. Their investment horizon is theoretically infinite, meaning that they can afford some really bad years or even decades if it maximizes returns over the next 100 or 200 years. Although both Harvard and Yale have had to make serious budget cuts lately to make up for lost endowment revenue. Yale President Richard Levin told the Wall Street Journal, "We made huge excess returns on the way up. When it's all over and things stabilize, I think we'll find the overall long-run performance of the endowment is better than if we didn't." I suspect he's right, but that doesn't necessarily make it a wise strategy for my mother-in-law. Diversify. When I teach finance, I like to have my students flip coins. It's the best way to make certain points. Here's one of them. A well-diversified portfolio will significantly lower the risk of serious losses without lowering your expected return. Let's turn to the coins. Suppose the return on the $100,000 you have tucked away in a 401k depends on the flip of a coin. Heads, it quadruples in value. Tails, you lose everything. The average outcome of this exercise is very good. Your expected return is 100%. The expected return is 0.5 or $400,000 plus 0.5 or $0 equals $200,000, which is a 100% return on your $100,000 investment. The problem, of course, is that the downside is unacceptably bad. You have a 50% chance of losing your whole nest egg. Try explaining that to a spouse. So let's bring in some more coins. Suppose you spread the $100,000 in your 401k into 10 different investments, each with the same payoff scheme. Heads, the investment quadruples in value. Tails, it becomes worthless. Your expected return has not changed at all. On average, you'll flip 5 heads and 5 tails. 5 of your investments would quadruple in value, and 5 would become worthless. That works out to the same handsome 100% return. But look at what has happened to your downside risk. The only way you can lose your entire 401k is by flipping 10 tails, which is highly unlikely. The probability is less than 1 in 1,000. Now imagine the same exercise if you buy several index funds that include thousands of stocks from around the world. This exercise is somewhat oversimplified. The flips of a coin are independent, while the performance of individual stocks are not. Some events, such as an interest rate hike, will affect the whole market. Thus, buying 2 stocks will not offer as much diversification as would splitting your portfolio between 2 flips of a coin. Nonetheless, the broader point is valid. That many coins will never come up all tails. Of course, you better make darn sure that all those investments have outcomes that are truly independent of one another. It's one thing to flip coins, where the outcome of one flip is uncorrelated with the outcome of the next flip. It's quite another to buy shares of Microsoft and Intel and then assume that you've safely split your portfolio into 2 baskets. Yes, they are different companies with different products and different management. But if Microsoft has a really bad year, there's a pretty good chance that Intel will suffer too. One of the mistakes that compounded the financial crisis was the belief that bundling lots of mortgages together into a single mortgage-backed security created an investment that was safer and more predictable than any single mortgage, like flipping 100 coins instead of just one. If you are a bank with one mortgage loan outstanding, it could go into default, taking all of your capital with it. But if you buy a financial product constructed from thousands of mortgages, most of them will be fine, which offsets the risk of the occasional default. During normal times, that's probably true. A mortgage goes into default when someone gets sick or loses a job. That's not likely to be highly correlated across households. If one house on the block goes into foreclosure, there's no reason to believe that others will, too. When a real estate bubble pops, everything is different. housing prices were plummeting all over the country, and the accompanying recession meant that lots and lots of people were losing jobs. The seemingly clever securities, backed by real estate loans, morphed into the toxic assets that we've been trying to clean up ever since. Invest for the long run. Have you ever been in a casino when someone wins big? The casino operators are just as happy as everybody else. Why? Because they're going to make an extraordinary amount of money in the long run. This is just one minor hiccup along the way. The beauty of running a casino is that the numbers are stacked in your favor. If you're willing to wait long enough and pose happily for photos as you give a giant check to the occasional big winner, then you will get rich. Investing has the same benefits as running a casino. The odds are stacked in your favor if you're patient and willing to endure the occasional setback. Any reasonable investment portfolio must have a positive expected return. Remember, you've rented capital to assorted entities and you expect to get something back in return. Indeed, the riskier the ventures, the more you expect to get back, on average. So the longer you hold your diversified investments, the longer you have for probability to work its magic. Where will the Dow close tomorrow? I have no clue. Where will it be next year? I don't know. Where will it be in 5 years? Probably higher than it is today, but that's no sure thing. Where will it be in 25 years? Significantly higher than it is today. I'm reasonably certain of it. The idiocy of day trading, buying a stock in hopes of selling it several hours later at a profit, is that it incurs all the costs of trading stocks, commissions and taxes, not to mention your time, without any of the benefits that come from holding equities for the long run. So there you have it. The sniff test for personal investing. The next time an investment advisor comes to you promising a 20 or 40% return, you know that one of three things must be true. One, this must be a very risky investment in order to justify such a high expected return. Think Harvard endowment. 2. Your investment advisor has stumbled upon an opportunity still undiscovered by all the world's sophisticated investors, and he's been kind enough to share it with you. Please call me. Or 3. Your investment advisor is incompetent and or dishonest. Think Bernie Madoff. All too often, the answer is 3. The fascinating thing about economics is that the fundamental ideas don't change. Monarchs in the Middle Ages needed to raise capital, usually to fight wars, just as biotech startups do today. I have no idea what the planet will look like in 100 years. Perhaps we'll be settling Mars or converting salt water into a clean, renewable source of energy. I do know that either of those undertakings would use the financial markets to raise capital and to mitigate risk. And I'm positive that Americans will not have become thin and healthy by eating only grapefruit and ice cream. Chapter 8. The Power of Organized Interests. What economics can tell us about politics. Many years ago, I took a vacation with a group of friends. As the sole academic among the bunch, I was the object of mild curiosity. When I explained that I was studying public policy, one of my peers asked skeptically, "If people know so much about public policy, then why is everything so messed up?" On the one hand, the question was idiotic. It's a bit like asking, "If we know so much about medicine, why do people keep dying all the time?" One can always come up with clever rejoinders a decade later. At the time, I mumbled something like, "Well, it's complicated." I might have pointed out that in the realm of public policy, as in medicine, we've achieved some pretty good wins. Americans are healthier, richer, better educated, and less vulnerable to economic booms and busts than at any time in our history, the recent economic downturn notwithstanding. Still, the question has stuck with me for years, in large part because it hints at an important point. Even when economists reach consensus on policies that would make us better off, those policies often run into a brick wall of political opposition. International trade is a perfect example. I'm not aware of a single mainstream economist who believes that international trade is anything less than crucial to the well-being of rich and poor countries alike. There's just one small problem. It's an issue that literally causes riots in the streets. Even before the violent anti-globalization protests in places like Seattle and Genoa, agreements to expand trade, such as the North American Free Trade Agreement, caused ferocious political battles. Meanwhile, pork barrel legislation sails through Congress, lavishing money on small projects that cannot possibly be described as promoting the national interest. For nearly 40 years, the federal budget included a cash payment to American mohair farmers. Mohair comes from the Angora goat and is a wool substitute. The mohair subsidy was created in 1955 at the behest of the armed forces to ensure a sufficient supply of yarn for military uniforms in the event of a war. I won't quibble with that. But the military switched to synthetic fibers for its uniforms around 1960. The government continued to give large cash payments to mohair farmers for another 35 years. The mohair subsidy was eventually eliminated when it became the poster child for pork barrel politics and was doomed by its sheer absurdity. And then, when the rest of us turned our attention elsewhere, it came back. The 2008 Farm Bill includes subsidies for wool and mohair producers for the crop years 2008 to 2012. How does this happen? It's not because the mohair farmers are enormously powerful, well-funded, or politically sophisticated. They are not any of those things. In fact, the small number of mohair farmers is an advantage. What the mohair farmers have going for them is that they can get large payments from the government without taxpayers ever really noticing. Suppose there are 1,000 mohair farmers, each of whom gets a check from the federal government for $100,000 every spring, just for being a mohair farmer. The farmers who get that subsidy care a lot about it, probably more than they care about any other government policy. Meanwhile, the rest of us, who pay mere pennies extra in taxes to preserve an unnecessary supply of mohair, don't care much about it at all. Any politician with a preference for job security can calculate that a vote for the mohair subsidy will earn the strong support of the mohair farmers while costing nothing among other voters. It's a political no-brainer. The problem is that mohair farmers aren't the only group lining up to get a subsidy, or a tax break, or trade protection, or some other government policy that puts money in their pockets. Indeed, the most savvy politicians can trade favors with one another. If you support the mohair farmers in my district, then I'll support the Bingo Hall of Fame in your district. During my days as a speechwriter for the governor of Maine, we used to refer to the state budget as a Christmas tree. Every legislator could hang an ornament or two. I currently live in the Illinois 5th Congressional District, the seat held for decades by Dan Rostenkowski, and later by Rahm Emanuel. We Chicagoans can drive around the city and literally point to the things that Rosty built. When the Museum of Science and Industry needed tens of millions of dollars to build an underground parking garage, Dan Rostenkowski found federal funds. Should taxpayers in Seattle or rural Vermont have paid for a parking garage at a Chicago museum? Of course not. But when I took my children to the museum last weekend in a downpour, I was delighted to be able to park indoors. That helps to explain why Dan Rostenkowski, not long out of federal prison, can still command a standing ovation at political gatherings in Chicago. The stimulus bill passed by the Obama administration during the depths of the financial crisis was a giant legislative Christmas tree. I'll argue in the next chapter that the stimulus was a reasonable thing to do under the circumstances. No sane person, however, would have designed that particular bill, which included funding for things ranging from green golf carts to a polar icebreaker. Yes, The process that has generated decades of cash payments for mohair farmers is alive and well. Let's talk about ethanol, a corn-based gasoline additive with putative environmental benefits. Gasoline blended with ethanol is taxed 5.4 cents less per gallon than pure gasoline, ostensibly because it burns more cleanly than pure gasoline and because it lowers our dependence on foreign oil. Of course, neither scientists nor environmentalists are convinced that ethanol is such a great thing. A 1997 study by the General Accounting Office, which later changed its name to the Government Accountability Office, the nonpartisan research arm of Congress, found that ethanol had little effect on either the environment or our dependence on foreign oil. The ethanol subsidy had, however, cost the Treasury $7.1 billion in foregone tax revenues. Worse, ethanol may actually make some kinds of air pollution worse. It evaporates faster than pure gasoline, contributing to ozone problems in hot temperatures. A 2006 study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences concluded that ethanol does reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 12% relative to gasoline, but it calculated that devoting the entire U.S. corn crop to make ethanol would replace only a small fraction of American gasoline consumption. Corn farming also contributes to environmental degradation due to runoff from fertilizer and pesticides. But to dwell on the science is to miss the point. As the New York Times noted in the throes of the 2000 presidential race, regardless of whether ethanol is a great fuel for cars, it certainly works wonders in Iowa campaigns. The ethanol tax subsidy increases the demand for corn, which puts money in farmers' pockets. Just before the Iowa caucuses, corn farmer Marvin Flyer told the Times, "Sometimes I think the candidates just come out and pander to us," he said. Then he added, "Of course, that may not be the worst thing." The National Corn Growers Association figures that the ethanol program increases the demand for corn, which adds 30 cents to the price of every bushel sold. Bill Bradley opposed the ethanol subsidy during his three terms as a senator from New Jersey, not a big corn-growing state. Indeed, some of his most important accomplishments as a senator involve purging the tax code of subsidies and loopholes that collectively do more harm than good. But when Bill Bradley arrived in Iowa as a Democratic presidential candidate back in 1992, he spoke to some farmers and suddenly found it in his heart to support tax breaks for ethanol. In short, he realized that ethanol is crucial to Iowa voters, and Iowa is crucial to the presidential race. Since then, every mainstream presidential candidate has supported the ethanol subsidy, except one, John McCain. To his credit, Senator McCain generally opposed ethanol subsidies during his presidential runs in both 2000 and 2008. While Senator McCain's straight talk is admirable, let's remind ourselves of one important detail. John McCain is not currently President of the United States. That would be Barack Obama, an ethanol subsidy supporter. Ethanol is not a case of a powerful special interest pounding the rest of us into submission. Farmers are a scant 2 or 3% of the population. Even fewer of them actually grow corn. If squeezing favors out of the political process were simply a matter of brute strength, then those of us who can't tell a heifer from a steer should be kicking the farmers around. Indeed, America's right-handed voters could band together and demand tax breaks at the expense of the lefties, and we could really have our way with those mohair farmers. But that's not what happens. Economists have come up with a theory of political behavior that fits better with what we actually observe. When it comes to interest group politics, it pays to be small. Gary Becker, the same University of Chicago Nobel Prize winner who figured so prominently in our thinking about human capital, wrote a seminal paper in the early 1980s that nicely encapsulated what had become known as the economics of regulation. Building on work that went all the way back to Milton Friedman's doctoral dissertation, Becker theorized that, All else equal, small, well-organized groups are most successful in the political process. Why? Because the costs of whatever favors they wrangle out of the system are spread over a large, unorganized segment of the population. Think about ethanol again. The benefits of that $7 billion tax subsidy are bestowed on a small group of farmers, making it quite lucrative for each one of them. Meanwhile, the costs are spread over the remaining 98% of us, putting ethanol somewhere below good oral hygiene on our list of everyday concerns. The opposite would be true with my plan to have left-handed voters pay subsidies to right-handed voters. There are roughly 9 right-handed Americans for every lefty. So, if every right-handed voter were to get some government benefit worth $100, then every left-handed voter would have to pay $900 to finance it. The lefties would be hopping mad about their $900 tax bills, probably to the point that it became their preeminent political concern, while the righties would be only modestly excited about their $100 subsidy. An adept politician would probably improve her career prospects by voting with the lefties. Here's a curious finding that makes more sense in light of what we've just discussed. In countries where farmers make up a small fraction of the population, such as America and Europe, the government provides large subsidies for agriculture. But in countries where the farming population is relatively large, such as China and India, the subsidies go the other way. Farmers are forced to sell their crops at below market prices so that urban dwellers can get basic food items cheaply. In the one case, farmers get political favors. In the other, they must pay for them. What makes these examples logically consistent is that in both cases, the large group subsidizes the smaller group. In politics, the tail can wag the dog. This can have profound effects on the economy. Death by 1,000 subsidies. The cost of Dan Rostenkowski's underground parking garage at the Museum of Science and Industry is insignificant in the face of our $14 trillion economy. So is the ethanol subsidy. So is the trade protection for sugar producers and the tax break for pharmaceutical companies with operations in Puerto Rico and the price supports for dairy farmers. But in total, these things and the tens of thousands of others like them are significant. Little inefficiencies begin to disrupt the most basic function of a market economy, taking inputs and producing goods and services as efficiently as possible. If the government has to support the price of milk, the real problem is that there are too many dairy farmers. The best definition I've ever heard of a tax shelter is some kind of investment or behavior that would not make sense in the absence of tax considerations. And that's exactly the problem here. Governments should not be in the business of providing incentives for people to do things that would not otherwise make sense. Chapter 3 outlined all the reasons why good government is not just important, but essential. Yet it's also true that when Congress turns its attention to a problem, a lot of ornaments end up on the Christmas tree. The late George Stigler, a University of Chicago economist who won the Nobel Prize in 1982, proposed and defended a counterintuitive notion. Firms and industries often benefit from regulation. In fact, they can use the political process to generate regulation that either helps them or hobbles their competitors. Does that sound unlikely? Consider the case of teacher certification. Every state requires public school teachers to do or achieve certain things before becoming licensed. Most people consider that to be quite reasonable. In Illinois, the requirements for certification have risen steadily over time. Again, that seems reasonable, given our strong emphasis on public school reform. But when one begins to scrutinize the politics of certification, things become murkier. The teachers' unions, one of the most potent political forces in America, always support reforms that require more rigorous training and testing for teachers. Read the fine print, though. Almost without exception, these laws exempt current teachers from whatever new requirement is being imposed. In other words, individuals who would like to become teachers have to take additional classes or pass new exams. Existing teachers do not. That doesn't make much sense if certification laws are written for the benefit of students. If doing certain things is necessary in order to teach, then presumably anyone standing at the front of a classroom should have to do them. Other aspects of certification law don't make much sense either. Private school teachers, many of whom have decades of experience, cannot teach in public schools without jumping through assorted hoops, including student teaching, that are almost certainly unnecessary. Nor can university professors. When Albert Einstein arrived in Princeton, New Jersey, he was not legally qualified to teach high school physics. The most striking and frustrating thing about all of this is that researchers have found that certification requirements have virtually no correlation with performance in the classroom whatsoever. The best evidence on this point, which is consistent with all other evidence that I've seen, comes from Los Angeles. When California passed a law in the late 1990s to reduce class size across the state, Los Angeles had to hire a huge number of new teachers, many of whom were uncertified. Los Angeles also collected classroom-level data on the performance of students assigned to any given teacher. A study done for the Hamilton Project, a public policy think tank, looked at the performance of 150,000 students over 3 years and came to two conclusions. 1. Good teachers matter. Students assigned to the best quarter of teachers ended up 10 percentile points ahead of students given the worst quarter of teachers, controlling for the student's initial level of achievement. And 2. Certification doesn't matter. The study found no statistically significant achievement differences between students assigned to certified teachers and students assigned to uncertified teachers. The authors of the study recommend that states eliminate entry barriers that keep talented people from becoming public school teachers. Most states are doing the opposite. Mr. Stigler would have argued that all of this is easy to explain. Just think about how the process benefits teachers, not students. Making it harder to become a teacher reduces the supply of new entrants into the profession, which is a good thing for those who are already there. Any barrier to entry looks attractive from the inside. I have a personal interest in all kinds of occupational licensure, cases in which states require that individuals become licensed before practicing certain professions. My doctoral dissertation set out to explain a seemingly anomalous pattern in Illinois. The state requires barbers and manicurists to be licensed, but not electricians. A shoddy electrical job could burn down an entire neighborhood. A bad manicure or haircut seems relatively more benign. Yet the barbers and manicurists are the ones regulated by the state. The short explanation for the pattern is two words: interest groups. The best predictor of whether or not a profession is licensed in Illinois is the size and budget of its professional association. Every profession is small relative to the state's total population. So all of these groups have the mohair advantage. The size and budget of the professional association reflects the extent to which members of the profession have organized to exploit it. Remarkably, political organization is a better predictor of licensure than the danger members of the profession pose to the public, as measured by their liability premium. George Stigler was right. Groups seek to get themselves licensed. Small organized groups fly under the radar and prevail upon legislators to do things that do not necessarily make the rest of us better off. Economists, particularly those among the more free market Chicago school, are sometimes perceived to be hostile toward government. It would be more accurate to describe them as skeptical. The broader the scope of government, the more room there is for special interests to carve out deals for themselves, that have nothing to do with the legitimate functions of government described in Chapter 3. Tyranny of the status quo. If small groups can get what they want out of the legislative process, they can also stop what they don't want, or at least try. Joseph Schumpeter, who coined the term creative destruction, described capitalism as a process of incessantly destroying the old structure and creating a new one. That may be good for the world. It's bad for the firms and industries that make up the old structure. The individuals standing in capitalism's path of progress, or destruction from their standpoint, will use every tool they have to avoid it, including politics. And why shouldn't they? The legislative process helps those who help themselves. Groups under siege from competition may seek trade protection, a government bailout, favorable tax considerations, limitations on a competing technology, or some other special treatment. With layoffs or bankruptcy looming, the plea to politicians for help can be quite compelling. So what's the problem? The problem is that we don't get the benefits of the new economic structure if politicians decide to protect the old one. Roger Ferguson, Jr., former vice chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, explains, "Policymakers who fail to appreciate the relationship between the relentless churning of the competitive environment and wealth creation will end up focusing their efforts on methods and skills that are in decline. In so doing, they establish policies that are aimed at protecting weak, outdated technologies, and in the end, they slow the economy's march forward." Both politics and compassion suggest that we ought to offer a hand to those mowed over by competition. If some kind of wrenching change generates progress, then the pie must get bigger. And if the pie gets bigger, then at least some of it ought to be offered to the losers, be it in the form of transition aid, job retraining, or whatever else will help those who have been knocked over to get back on their feet. One of the features that made the North American Free Trade Agreement more palatable was a provision that offered compensation to workers whose job losses could be tied to expanded trade with Mexico. Similarly, many states are using money from the massive legal settlement with the tobacco industry to compensate tobacco farmers whose livelihoods are threatened by declining tobacco use. There's a crucial distinction, however, between using the political process to build a safety net for those harmed by creative destruction and using the political process to stop that creative destruction in the first place. Think about the Telegraph and the Pony Express. It would have been one thing to help displaced Pony Express workers by retraining them as telegraph operators. It would have been quite another to help them by banning the telegraph. Sometimes the political process does the equivalent of the latter, for reasons related to the mohair problem. The economic benefits of competition are huge, but spread over a large group. The costs tend to be smaller, but highly concentrated. As a result, the beneficiaries of creative destruction hardly notice. The losers chain themselves to their congressman's office door, seeking protection, as any of us might if our livelihood or community were at risk. Such is the case in the realm of international trade. Trade is good for consumers. We pay less for shoes, cars, electronics, food, and everything else that could be made better or more cheaply somewhere else in the world, or is made more cheaply in this country because of foreign competition. Our lives are made better in thousands of little ways that have a significant cumulative effect. Looking back on the Clinton presidency, former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin reflected, "The economic benefits of the tariff reductions we negotiated over the last 8 years represent the largest tax cut in the history of the world. Cheaper shoes here, a better television there. Still probably not enough to get the average person to fly somewhere and march in favor of the World Trade Organization, or WTO. Meanwhile, those most directly affected by globalization have a more powerful motivation. In one memorable case, the AFL-CIO and other unions did send some 30,000 members to Seattle in 1999 to protest against broadening the WTO. The flimsy pretext was that the union is concerned about wages and working conditions in the developing world. Nonsense. The AFL-CIO is worried about American jobs. More trade means cheaper goods for millions of American consumers and lost jobs and shuttered plants. That's something that will motivate workers to march in the streets, as it has been throughout history. The original Luddites were bands of English textile workers who destroyed textile-making machinery to protest the low wages and unemployment caused by mechanization. What if they had gotten their way?